Hello, I'm Jason Solomons, and this is Film Weekly, part of the Webby Award-winning family of Guardian podcasts. Okay, enough with the self-congratulations already. Let's get down to business on this edition of Film Weekly.
Well, I've always thought of women as subversive, so therefore a woman pursuing a young man seems to be good stuff.
British director Stephen Frears talking about subversion, love and money as he directs the sparkling Michelle Pfeiffer in his latest film, Sherry. And
we had all these small ski jumps around the city, so it was less than 10 minutes to a ski jump wherever you lived in my city.
Who'd have thought ski jumps can make great cinema? Norwegian director Bent Hammer and I hurtle headlong into his tale that is O. Horton. Zan Brooks will be joining me to flex our critical wits over the week's reviews. We'll be looking at the return of Star Trek and a Mexican love story, Blue Eyelids. Yes, we're boldly podcasting where no one has podcasted before. It's Film Weekly.
You think you can go on drifting back and forth between Edmé and me? Is that what you have in mind? Well, if it is, you'll have to learn to look a good deal less guilty than that.
Unless she's a lot stupider than I take her for.
Or perhaps you think you can get your mother to keep her under lock and key while you wander around doing what you feel like. She's not going to put up with it forever, you know. Don't forget, she's Mari Lor's daughter. The poison's bound to come out somehow or another. She may
Stop
be...
Stop it, Noonoon! I can't allow you to ruin my idea of you.
What?
Talking like that, you sound like my mother! Before I got married, you said to me, be kind to her, try not to let her suffer. That's what you're like. You're a good person. Even last night, you said you hoped I hadn't done something cruel. You're above all that! Noonoon. That's why I've always loved you.
That was Michelle Pfeiffer as the aging courtesan Madame Leia and Rupert Friend as her young lover Sherry in Stephen Frears' latest film, Sherry. The film tells of the doomed affair between an aging, still beautiful courtesan, played by Pfeiffer, who takes as a lover Sherry, the young son of a bitter rival. All seems well until young Sherry is married off, and they begin a ménage à trois, which seems to please no one. When I met up with Stephen Frears, director of The Queen, The Grifters, and of course Dangerous Liaisons, I asked him what attracted him to the world of Colette's original novel.
Well, because Christopher Hampton had written a very good script of it. That was really all I needed.
Yes, I mean, you'd worked with him before, obviously, on Dangerous Liaisons, and with Michelle Pfeiffer, who was your brilliant Torvel in that. A bit of a change for her in this one. In this one, she's the kind of sexual protagonist.
The boy is the sexual protagonist, yes. I liked all that. I liked it being the wrong way around.
Yeah, but that, what about that appeal to you? Because I think it sort of fits with what you've been doing of late.
Well, I've always thought of women as subversive, so therefore a woman pursuing a young man seemed to be good stuff.
Yes, and Michelle Pfeiffer doing it as well.
Absolutely.
You worked with her, it was her first Oscar nomination when you had her in Dangerous Liaisons.
Is that right?
Was that sort of key in, you know, did you go through your Rolodex of kind of what glamorous women I have worked with?
Well, I have worked with many, many beautiful women and I'm rather astonished to have done that. But she was absolutely on the money. She was the right age.
And yeah, she's brilliant in it.
She's very, very handsome, yes.
What does she like to actually film, Michelle Pfeiffer? Because she's a curious screen animal.
She's very, very tricky. You have to get the camera in the right place. If you don't get the camera in the right place, she's quite inexpressive. Then you bring the camera in the right place and she simply comes to life.
So do you have to work with her on that?
No, she's incredibly disciplined and skillful, but you have to put the camera in the right place. And she's very, very powerful, and it's quite mysterious, her power. I remember looking at her in a big wide shot and thinking, why is this woman able to make this shot work? She's a tiny little figure running along a wall or something. So she's got power, where it comes from, how you get that from the checkout desk in an Orange County supermarket, I don't know, but she's got it.
I mean, it seems to me that you kind of identify that quite often in your actresses. Like you had it with Helen Mirren in The Queen most recently, and got her an Oscar in that way. Is there a sort of synergy between the director and the leading lady that you'll find? You had a marvellous performance from Judy Dench in Mrs. Henderson's Presents, of course, as well.
No, I mean, the truth is, once you cast them, you can't stop them there. You know, they're like rockets. Come back, you know, all the back. They're very, very skillful and very, very good. You know, as usual, it's the casting that's crucial.
I mean, that's something that you've always been very keen on and cast extremely widely and extremely well. I mean, if we go back to Dangerous Liaisons, which we mentioned, you had Glenn Close sort of play, who was also struggling with age, as a woman, kind of that wonderful final shot of her taking her mask off. If you like, and you did it in The Grifters as well, which had pitted Angelica Houston against Annette Bening.
There's always a pairing.
Yes, I mean, you seem to kind of invite this kind of examination from actresses of their condition.
Well, it must be something deep in my psyche, and you should consult an analyst. I mean, I don't bother to think about it, but I noticed there have been a lot of very, very good women in my films, being very, very good, and being very strong and complicated.
Yes, I mean, I don't know. I always sort of struggled. I've asked you this before, and you always sort of shy away from anything that connects all your films. But the last three...
No, I'm aware they've all been about strong women. Well, I had a strong mother.
Yes. Well, I mean, it wasn't because it's not the first... I mean, you didn't do it early on in your career, but when The Grifters came along, I suddenly started thinking there was a... I know that was a noirish genre piece.
There was a period from The Laundrette to up to The Grifters where I made a whole series of films in which gay people, women, were somehow subversive and a way of, I imagine, attacking Mrs. Thatcher. so... We had a good role model. But I noticed that they politicised films in a particular way, just by being women or by being gay or persecuted or Pakistani, presumably.
Because, I mean, you've always done extremely different things, really. But when you started, as you brought us back to Laundrette, let's go back to the mid-80s Britain, if we have to. It's a very different place now, Britain. What was it like making films in 1980?
Well, actually, it was rather similar. I mean, there was, I think, no films being made at that precise moment. Goldcrest had collapsed. And that was exactly the moment we made The Laundrette and invented a new run of films that were coming out of Channel 4.
Yeah, I think 1984 was the low point. I think there were six made.
Always the time to start. When things are catastrophic.
It can only go up.
That's right. So, credit crunch, now's the time to... I mean, I'm surprised that no one has... You know, now is the time to make a film like The Laundrette.
What do you mean? You mean low budget?
I mean very low, and that changes everything, that attacks everything. I can remember on The Laundrette, you just had to attack everything because the script was so brilliant and so original.
But that was attacking racism, sexuality, poverty, which you did again in Sammy and Rose Did Get Laid.
Yeah.
Are those things still around, or what are the other things to attack?
It was also attacking Mrs. Thatcher.
So would you attack? I mean, you
I'd happily attack the city, bankers, Gordon Brown, a lot of them.
Well, you've sort of done New Labour in a way. It's rather more affectionate towards New Labour in the deal of the Queen than you were in
soft.
The...
I was soft. I've got softer.
Or maybe that. Well, maybe now is the time.
They're in more trouble now. But all I mean is that when you have no money, you have nothing. You have nothing to lose. And you just say, oh, let's go for everybody.
Mm. In fact, that kind of courses through your films. I always think about love and beauty and ageing is one theme you always have. But there's always this kind of someone spurred on by the fact they're going to lose it all.
Fury with the world.
But, I mean, Mrs. Henderson, that was a sort of business opportunity that Judi Dench seized on in that film.
That's right. And Enterprise,
Yeah, and Sherry is Enterprise is her very... Yes, she trades in it. Mm.
In the end, you'd like to make a film just called Money, because it's so riveting.
I think Martin Amis wrote that book.
Well, it was a wonderful book, but I've always wanted to make a film just about money. Last October, I got asked to make Wall Street 2, and it was just at the time when it all started. And I thought, oh, I've finally got to the centre of the universe. But of course, it was already out of date.
That would have been a Hollywood production, I think, with Michael Douglas.
Yes, but it was already out of date. That was the real problem. You said, well, you can't do this, because we know this didn't happen, and the world has moved on so fast.
Have you? Because you did go to Hollywood for a little while. You had that.
I've made films in Hollywood, yes.
And how have you refused the money to stay there? If you like,
what I learned in Hollywood was that I was much more independent than I realised. I thought I'd be a very good Hollywood director, but I was wrong.
But you were too independent.
Yes. Yeah.
Minded, or you like to work with independent?
I sort of helplessly independent, and when you. Well, the real division is not between America and Europe, it's between studio films and independent films. So whenever I made independent films in America, like High Fidelity or The Grifters, I always had a very good time and the films, you know, were okay. When I worked in the studio system, I couldn't sort of deal with it.
Let's go back to that theme of ageing that comes through. Not because you're doing it yourself rather gracefully, I would say. Which I think you probably, if I'd have asked you this in 1985, you probably would have thought you would have aged rather angrily.
Then, Even then I remember meeting a woman who said that she'd imagined that my beautiful laundrette was made by someone who wore leather trousers. In fact, I had two or three children by then. I was in my mid-40s and extremely respectable.
What sort of director do you think you've become? Or do you think that was always going to happen? As you say, you were fairly established when you made My Beautiful Laundrette, but you've still had a good 25 years of yes. churning them out, if you like.
It's come as a big surprise.
That you've been able to do this?
Yeah.
Have you improved as a director?
Oh, I think... Well, the truth is you lose... You look at, I mean, I very, very seldom look at my films because the risk is too great. But you can see that you lose your innocence, so you sit there thinking, oh, I could do it then, I can't do it now. But I actually don't think that. I think I've got much better. Mm. But of course, you lose and gain at the same time.
I was interested to see in the new film, Sherry, that you actually narrate it.
It's the first... Yes, not by... I mean, we added all that afterwards. I started doing a guide track in the cutting room. And then people kept saying, and Christopher started writing a very good narration. So I would do it. And then I kept saying this should be a woman. And I brought various women in to do it. And everyone just said, well, you're better. So I bowed gracefully to popular opinion.
Is that your first performance?
Probably my last, I imagine. I could see that it was easier for me. I knew why I was doing it. I knew what I was trying to tell people. And I could see that it would be very, very difficult for another person to learn all that I knew. So I could see that I was the storyteller and that I was the director. Therefore, it made sense, but it wasn't my intention.
Cherie is on release in the UK from Friday the 8th of May, and you can watch a version of that interview by going to my In the Director's Chair series at guardian.co.uk/in-the-director's-chair. The Guardian's Zan Brooks joins me in the Film Weekly studio. Zan, welcome back. Nice to
Thank
see you.
You had a week off. You were flying solo last week.
I know. It was a dangerous mission, one I undertook in your absence. It's nice to have you back co-piloting this week, especially as we boldly go into Star Trek this week. We're going to look at Sherry by Stephen Frears, Star Trek by J.J. Abrahams, and Blue Eyelids as well, a new film from Mexico by Ernesto Contreras. But let's start with Sherry, as we did hear from Stephen Frears just before. This is him back sort of on Dangerous Liaisons territory in France. Christopher Hampton, Michelle Pfeiffer. Haven't we been here before?
We have been here before. Do you know, the weird thing about Sherry is that when I first heard about it, I thought that after his recent adventures with The Deal and The Queen, that this was going to be the third part of a trilogy, the Sherry Blair story.
Do you know what? I completely forgot to put that to him. Absolutely right.
Which perhaps fortunately it's not.
Yes.
This is based on two novels by Colette, set in the Belle Epoque era of 20s Paris. And yet it's not Dangerous Liaisons. It's nothing like as good as Dangerous Liaisons.
Is it bad, though?
I kind of thought it was.
Really? Okay. Why did it not work for you?
I thought that it was very over-decorated and fussy and a little kind of constricted. You could almost kind of feel that the air being kind of pinched out of it. I think that there's a problem maybe with making a film about sort of an arched, mannered society and not having the film itself being kind of arch and mannered. But this felt a little prissy to me.
It's interesting you say that, Zan, because I thought that I might have that issue with the film, but I actually came to kind of be beguiled by Michelle Pfeiffer's central performance as this ageing courtesan who was really kind of battling with ageing itself as a kind of enemy against her. I know what you're saying, that I think it kind of suffered from a constricted budget. There was lots of expensive furniture and it's a great furniture film. I mean, it's fantastic frocks.
And great clothes, yeah.
Really good clothes. But it did suffer from, we're just two people in a room talking again, and scene after scene after scene
it became kind of relentless in a very sort of genteel way, didn't it? I know what you mean about Michelle Pfeiffer. I think Michelle Pfeiffer is a brilliant actor, and it's good to see her getting a comeback role of sorts. But I think that, you know, as you were saying, she's worked with Frizz before on Dangerous Liaisons, and that was kind of always in the back of my mind and thinking, this just isn't as substantial, it's not as meaty. She's there as a decorative kind of being. And although, yes, she is having to kind of communicate this pain and this sort of aging process and everything, at the same time, you're still being asked to kind of look at her swan around in nice dresses too much.
Yeah, there was some really good dresses, though, as well. A gold brocade kimono number in particular took my eye. I just thought that it sort of did build up to a kind of plangency at a certain point. And she describes herself as an old vase with beautiful handles. And I felt there was a poignancy just watching her. But I do know what you say, that, and I thought Rupert Friend wasn't bad as well, actually. He's got this kind of feyness to him. That is...
Again, Rupert Friend, I mean, it's a difficult performance because Rupert Friend is the sort of the 19-year-old who she sort of takes under her wing and has this sort of very strange kind of swooning relationship with, looking after him. And because of that, there's a slight sort of Bosie quality to him, I guess. Yes. But he is a kind of blank slate.
He's Lord Alfred Bosie rather than the speakers and subwoofers pioneer.
Or the guy out of Happy Days. He was Bosley, wasn't he?
Yes. Charlie's Angels.
Charlie's Angels. Sorry. I'm mixing up my trash TV. We'll get onto Star Trek in a minute too. But he's a kind of blank slate, and he's a projection. So, he's just there to look pretty. And there were too many people there to look pretty in this film.
Well, it was about the Belle Epoque where prettiness was everything, though, isn't it?
But it's not everything.
It's not something.
It's something. I'm not doing down the pretty folk.
I'm looking at my notes, and there's a lot of kind of notes about blue chiffon, powder blue, Marjorelle desks, beautiful kind of stuff. I mean, it's just about stuff.
Yeah, it is. It's like kind of, and the film felt like kind of being ushered into a drawing room and sat in the corner and watching these people kind of prancing around.
What I did want was more sex. It was a film
you
about
always
sex.
Want that, though, Jason.
I know.
No matter what it is. If it's some sort of worthy art house documentary, you always complain there's not enough sex.
It's usually car chases, though. I don't have enough of it. And there is a little bit of futting, kind of early motoring going on in this. I couldn't quite work out if there was a big audience for this film. It's not exactly, following up from The Queen,
no,
is it?
It's the sort of film for people who never go to the cinema anyway, isn't it? I mean, the people who might enjoy this, I think, would never kind of mix with the hoi polloi.
Michelle Pfeiffer fans, who tend to be like my dad.
Yeah, I guess so. Eventually, of course, it'll be on DVD and TV, and they'll catch it there. And, this has probably all been factored into the moneymaker's kind of equation on this film. But I don't think it's a natural sell at the multiplex.
Well, you're certainly not selling it to anyone who wants to go to the multiplex. That's Sherry, which I quite like. Zan really doesn't like that much at all. Zan, let's boldly go into Star Trek then. It's a reimagining, it's a remake, it's a rebooting. We're back to the start. James Tiberius Kirk, Dr. Spock et al., reimagined by the man who made Lost, J.J. Abraham.
Enlist in Starfleet.
Enlist?
You guys must be way down on your recruiting quota for the month.
Now, if you're half the man your father was, Jim, Starfleet could use you. You can be an officer in 4 years. You can have your own ship in 8. You understand what the Federation is, don't you? It's important. It's a peacekeeping and humanitarian armada.
We done?
I'm done. Riverside Shipyard. Shuttle for new recruits leaves tomorrow, 0800. Your father was captain of a starship for 12 minutes.
He saved 800 lives, including your mother's and yours.
I dare you to do better.
That's Chris Pine as James T. Kirk being convinced to join the cadets because his dad was quite a good pilot-y person thing. Are you a Star Trek fan in the first place? I can see by your tight tunic that perhaps you are.
Do you know, I kind of think I probably wasn't. I mean, I used to watch it as a kid, but I used to watch everything as a kid. And I enjoyed it as a kid because
channels.
I enjoyed everything as a kid because I was dumb. So I'm not really, and I haven't seen the original Star Trek series probably for like 20 years now.
It must be ropey as hell.
I'm sure it is. But, do you know, I really like this. And I was very surprised because I went in as if like I was visiting the dentist or something in that kind of, oh, my God. And I was kind of blown away. And I thought that if you are going to have a big, crass, bells and whistles summer blockbuster, why not have this one? This is good.
Zan, I hate Star Trek. I hate everything about it. Set phases to stun, warp factor this, Spock, its logical captain. But I tell you what, this was damn good.
It's great, isn't it? Again, it's an origins story. And what I mean, this is a real little sort of big budget subgenre that's happening after the Wolverine thing last week. This so goes back to the birth of the Enterprise and how they all came to be there.
Which is always good because, as far as I know, since we've been growing up, and you mentioned that, they were just always there. So
they're
it's quite
there.
Nice
yeah,
to know what
fixtures.
The hell they
exactly,
were doing
yeah.
there in the first place.
Yeah, there's a sort of terrible circular quality to Star Trek, wasn't there? That they were just kind of boldly going and boldly going and boldly going and never stopped.
Never getting there.
But this is why, you know, when they first started boldly going. And so there's a novelty in that, if nothing else.
Although they don't say how they came to use the world's most famous split infinitive.
No, they don't do that. They don't do that. But they explain pretty much everything else. And, you know, Kirk, as played by William Shatner, as I recall, was a bit of a sort of straight arrow, wasn't he? He was a bit of a kind of young Republican. Whereas here, as played by Chris Pine, who looks, I have to say, worryingly like the young Jim Davidson. Here he's a sort of, you know, wild, crazy tearaway. But that kind of works too.
He's kind of horny as well. He's always like looking at girls.
What, the young Jim Davidson or Chris Pine?
The young Jim Davidson is probably quite horny. if we were allowed to talk about the great James Davidson.
No, let's save that for next week. And it's got a great performance from Zachary Quinto as well as Spock, who is, you know, uncannily like the young Spock, as
who
I remember.
Who is Zachary
from,
Quinto?
He was in Heroes, so he's got a kind of
that.
Cult following.
What's that? That's on television.
That's
well,
on BBC
it?
Two.
No,
it's another of these kind of geeky series that you run a mile from. I think, yes, it's ludicrous. It's got kind of black holes, and it's got this kind of alternative future where Leonard Nimoy comes back as the old Spock to play kind of mentor to the young Kirk, which, of course, doesn't add up. And also, the problem that I had with it was maybe it's so fast, it's so polished, it's so expert that I was kind of wondering if it's not a bit of a kind of bamboozler. It's like a sort of salesman, a fast-talking salesman, who goes so quickly that you're actually not sure if what he's saying adds up
but
at all.
But isn't that probably best? Otherwise, we'd stop and come out
maybe.
Of that spell and kind of realise
yeah,
that we
maybe.
Don't really like all
yeah.
this stuff. Because I kept thinking, well, I'm stop enjoying yourself, Jason. You don't like this stuff. You
exactly.
decided that. And I was having my sort of belief system shaken.
Yeah. Or if not shaken, then just kind of whip through so quickly that you don't have time to analyse it at
all. I liked its futurism. I think that's what got me. There were lots of wide shots that were quite awe-inspiring. Do see it on a big screen. I saw it at the Empire
yeah.
Leicester Square. It looks fantastic.
Yeah, it does,
and
yeah.
I was like, oh my God, that's what
yeah.
some of the movies are supposed
and
to
he's
look
a
like.
Great. J.J. Abrahams is a great action director. And he really sort of starts as he means to go on. It's got this kind of bravura opening sequence where, you know, the spaceship is under attack by this sort of Vulcan mothership. Explosions are going off. And then suddenly he throws in a pregnant wife who's going into labour, and you think, what else is he going to, you know, it's half expecting to see a kind of kitten trapped up a ladder that they had to rescue as well. And he's just kind of throwing everything at the screen, and it kind of works.
And there's even sex with green people.
There's sex
which
with
I
green
quite
people.
Liked.
And I guess Trekkies will ponder the significance of Uhuru fancying Spock, which I can't remember
more
from
than
the series.
Fancying.
Well, absolutely.
Snogging.
Yeah, snogging.
Maybe that's the origin
of
why his ears are so pointy.
Yes, well, you know, from the looks of Uhuru, she's enough to point up any
yeah,
man's
mine certainly
ears.
Were. It was really enjoyable, Star Trek. I don't know, I haven't seen all the rest of the summer movies, but that's an enjoyable summer movie.
If this is the best one we're going to get, that's okay.
All I could think of was that I really enjoyed this one. I can't really be bothered, because they're obviously going to do two,
oh, yeah,
three,
gonna,
four,
yeah.
five, and all that again. I'm not really up for another journey. I've quite enjoyed this one.
Wait
though.
And see. You may well be. It surprised
no,
you once.
I'm not. Let's move on to Mexico, Zan, and to Blue Eyelids, or to give it its full Mexican titles, Párpados Azules. This is a film by Ernesto Contreras, a strange film, slightly kind of unreal film, about a woman who, in an office prize draw, wins a holiday for two at Playa Salamandra.
...y una cena de lujo en el restaurante Finisterra con acompañamiento de violín.
Zan, in the era of swine flu, Mexico needs all the help it can get. Is it worth taking a journey into it via Párpados Azules, Blue Eyelids?
I think it is. If your tour guide is Ernesto Contreras, the writer-director, who I think is a debut writer-director.
I've never seen it or heard
no,
of it.
No, I think it's his first film. This is, I guess, this is the real antidote to Star Trek, isn't it? I mean, this is a very small, minor key film, and that is the delight of it, I think. You know, in its way, this is just as satisfying as the big budget Star Trek.
And it also has a great opening sequence, which we mentioned Star Trek's opening sequence, which really gets you into it. And this has a terrific opening sequence. And I thought, after about 5 minutes, I'm going to love this. Yeah, I actually was watching it and I didn't have my glasses on and I thought, and I stopped. I was like, I'm going to get my glasses because I don't want to miss any more of this.
Yeah. It does kind of draw you in very kind of neatly. And also, it's a film about a relationship. It's a film about a romance, I guess. And it made me kind of think just how crudely romances are done on screen. They're either kind of all wine and roses and everything's wonderful, or they're kind of low comedy disasters.
Yeah, there was a meet cute moment where they bump into each other with the orange juice or something.
Whereas this shows it in a much more honest way, I think. I mean, it shows it as something very kind of fragile and self-contained, and a little kind of storm of inner emotions,
I guess.
It kept
changing to me as well, the tone of this. I was like, is this a sort of a fantasy genre? Yeah. Because there was little talking birds. Is it a sort of fairy tale genre? Because it's narrated by an older woman. And then it's, as you say, a romantic comedy, but more about longing and loneliness and a real sadness to it.
Yeah, and the risk that people take in trying to kind of make a sort of fumbled connection with each other. And it captured that brilliantly. I mean, not just in the central romance between the heroine Marina, who meets up this guy called Victor, who claims to be sort of an old school friend, and she kind of tentatively starts going out with him and invites him on this holiday. But also Marina and her boss, who works in the garment factory that she works, and there's this sort of, you know, kind of a bit officious but lonesome kind of older woman who keeps her caged birds. And it's a film about relationships, and maybe that's not an easy sell if you're wanting, you know, big action and drama and everything. But within its minor key, kind of delicate way, it does this perfectly.
I thought it's obviously a very low budget film. As you said, I mean, Ernesto wrote and directed and did the editing as well.
Catering as well.
I think he did do the catering and probably the bird seeds, bird wrangling. But I thought the music by Iñaki Cano was great. The cinematography by someone called Tonatia Martinez was also fantastic. And it made a virtue of the smallness. When we talked about Sherry earlier, kind of slightly being suffocated by clearly what is a big budget. This one never... I enjoyed the suffocation of two people stuck in there, and the camera seemed to kind of find angles in the room to emphasise their loneliness or to kind of show the distance between them. The colour palette was extraordinary.
Absolutely.
I was hooked by it.
And there's a kind of spaciousness to it as well. For all of its kind of little confines, there's a sense that these characters were real and they have kind of a life outside the movies, which is the most kind of crucial thing for the success of a movie, that you actually think, yeah, I can imagine what they did next, where they went, where they came from.
Lovely performance as well in the lead by Cecilia
Absolutely
Suarez.
Yeah.
And him as well, Enrique Arriola, who you may recognise as the pizza delivery guy in Fernando Henrique's kind of art house black and white hit called Duck Season.
I miss Duck Season.
But do you remember it?
I remember the name Duck Season, and of course Duck Season is always a favourite season of mine.
Is it? Good.
Because yeah. they keep quacking. It's so entertaining.
It's better than swine season, surely, in Mexico. Had to get one in from Mexico. But a very interesting new voice there. And I do believe that Ernesto Contreras is coming to England now, to London, to make his next feature. So impressed were the producers of a British film with this, that they saw this at Sundance or something, and then they've got him over now to kind of work here in England.
That'd be very interesting, I mean, to see a director of his calibre adapting to that culture and whether he can kind of keep that sort of fresh take on things.
Yeah, he's definitely a name to watch. Ernesto Contreras, and I think he's done quite a lot of videos in Mexico and kind of pop promos, and that's why I think they got that lovely Ray Davies song, A Strange Effect, which kind of is woven through the film.
No, I highly recommend this.
This is one of those films that if you don't know, only me, because you've heard us talk about it here on Film Weekly, you might go along to your Renoir or your little local art house, your corner house or your Cameo, see how I spread the love out across the country, and find it. And it could be one of your favourite films of the summer.
Well, I think for us too. I mean, you know, we're so bombarded. I mean, you know, even though I had prejudices against Star Trek, I at least knew it was coming, and everyone knew it's coming. Whereas this, you know, it just slips under everybody's radar. It doesn't have that push, and it deserves it. It's a good film.
Well, Blue Eyelids fluttered them at us, and we were charmed. Thanks to Zan Brooks there for his reviews. For more of those and for more up-to-date comments, go to guardian.co.uk/film. That is the Norwegian Railwaymen's Choir there in the film O. Horton, released this week and directed by a man with one of the finest names in world cinema, director of films such as Factotum and Kitchen Stories, the Norwegian filmmaker Bent Hammer. His latest, O. Horton, is named after its central character, and Hammer continues to explore the quiet but bizarre events and characters of everyday life in Norway.
Horton is a long-serving train driver about to make the final journey of his distinguished career, but his life is going into meltdown, uncoupled, as it were, from the engine of what's powered it every day. The film has a startling opening sequence hurtling the viewer along a Norwegian railway line through tunnels and into expansive northern Norway scenery, a metaphor, surely, for Horton's new life. So when I met up with director Bent Hammer, I asked him how he conceived of the opening to this film and how he came to the story of Horton.
To tell you the truth, the whole opening of the film is inspired by a TV channel I saw when I was in London, did press during the London Film Festival for Factotum. Yeah. Came home early in the morning and I couldn't sleep, so I turned on the TV and it was this train channel when they put up a camera in front of the train and just drive. And I couldn't really, I mean, it sounds boring, but I couldn't really turn off the TV. I had to just to watch around the next bend. And it went out and in of tunnels, and to shorten it in the tunnels, they just cut to the engineer and then back again, and it went out of the tunnel. And after quite a while, I started to think this is a wonderful way of opening the film. Mm. And you just show him in his work. And in the end, we come up on the mountains of Norway. So it was really inspired by what I saw there early in the morning years ago.
Well, great things come from sleepless nights,
yeah,
I think.
Exactly.
I like the details. I suppose in a film like this where it's a quiet story about a quiet man, it's the details that we're attracted to. I love the way he smokes his pipe, sort of like he's like a train himself, isn't he? The sort of smoke coming out of his mouth like an old-fashioned steam locomotive.
Yeah, I'm very happy that I wanted him to smoke a pipe, but I asked that was the first thing I asked the actor Bordeaux about, also that if he could smoke a pipe, because if you don't believe in it, it's horrible to see, yeah, even if you're smoking cigarettes. But he used to be a pipe smoker when he was younger, so it was easy for him, and then it was all set.
Right, so were there actors you auditioned? You said, sorry, you don't smoke a pipe, you can't come in?
No, I didn't, but I think I would have taken it out if I didn't believe in the character that he was a pipe smoker.
It seems sort of like Kitchen Stories, and again, I don't want to say that you're repeating yourself, but the film has these, as I say, these moments which are kind of surreal and very funny because of them. And I think, for example, of the chef in a restaurant who just randomly suddenly gets arrested. Are these things that, I mean, you say that you get inspiration from not being able to sleep at the London Film Festival. Where do these inspirational stories come from?
From the closest restaurant from my apartment in Oslo, actually. So it happened.
Really? You were dining one day and the chef got arrested?
It was actually my editor who told me the story. He went in there and suddenly there was two guys coming in, and it was an old lady who was serving one of these brown places in Oslo, and she closed the door and said no more orders, but you can drink up your beers, and then they arrested the chef and took him out. So it happened.
It does happen.
So I just stole it.
There are other sort of strange incidences, but I suppose ski jumping forms quite a big part of it, which for an English person is a bit odd. And we had Eddie the Eagle Edwards, of course, who is the world's worst ski jumper. But ski jumping is obviously big business in Norway. A lot of people do it.
Absolutely. And when I was a kid, it was even, most kids was ski jumping. We had all these small ski jumps around the city, so it was less than 10 minutes to a ski jump wherever you lived in my city and all around Norway, I think.
So, because it is an interesting, I've never really seen it used before. I mean, we've had downhill racer, we've had bobsleigh as a kind of motif, but the ski jumping never before. You know, there's an existential narrative to ski jumping, isn't there? And I suppose that's what really your film has.
Yeah, I like the whole meaning of it also, of course. And yeah, I've been thinking about it for a while, but never used it before. But I think it was in my, say, ID bank in a way.
Yeah, absolutely. It's rather beautiful as well, and it kind of ties up with the train. Yeah. We're all journeying somewhere, jumping off the cliff. Is that what filmmaking is like for you? Is it a sort of jump into the void?
Yes, exactly like that.
Ben, absolutely lovely to see you. Congratulations on your film, O. Horton. Lovely to finally get you on Film Weekly with your wonderful name. It's still very funny in English. Might not work in Norway, but that's humour for you. Congratulations on O. Horton. That's humour that does travel. Cheers.
Thank you.
The quirky but noble tale of an everyday man, O. Horton, is released this Friday, May the 8th, here in the UK. And I do recommend taking the leap into Bent Hammer's previous films, especially Kitchen Stories. And that is all for this edition of Film Weekly. Thanks to all my guests this week, to Stephen Frears, to Bent Hammer, and to Zana Brooks, of course. We shall be in Cannes next week, coming to you live and direct from the Croisette, where the heavyweights of art house filmmaking do battle in the Palais de Festival. Do join us there, and join us on Facebook. Film Weekly Fans is our group. Let us know what you've been watching and your opinions about anything you've heard in this week's or any other week's show. By the way, the music you've been listening to this week comes from the excellent soundtrack to Cherry. The composer is the Oscar-nominated Alexandre Desplat. Excellent, n'est-ce pas? But for now, from me, Jason Solomons, and my producer on Film Weekly, Jason Phipps, it's goodbye.